Inside Julia's Kitchen is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill. Employee-owned Bob's Red Mill offers organic, gluten-free, stone-ground products. Visit bobsredmill.com today.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. The topic? Restaurants and rules. Some rules are based on religion.
This makes for an unusual scene in a Manhattan restaurant. A shy 20-year-old dictating the kitchen standards to a humble veteran chef.
While other rules promote health and safety.
But who are these feared rule keepers with the power to shut a restaurant down?
They're not really like food lovers.
Some restaurant rules fall outside the domain of the kitchen.
All civil rights issues have basically, at one point or another, revolved around the bathroom.
For more, tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the good fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome Anita Lowe, the former chef owner of the Michelin-starred restaurant Anissa in Greenwich Village and author of the recently released cookbook, Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Anita about her new cookbook, life after nearly two decades running her own restaurant, and we'll hear Anita's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. In the first part of Inside Julia's Kitchen, as always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Julia once said, "The more you know, the more you can create. There's no end to imagination in the kitchen." Now, Julia wasn't saying just dash into the kitchen, throw on a beret, do whatever, in a mad burst of trying to be creative. The emphasis is on the learning part first. Learn your craft, know your stuff, know a lot of stuff, and then, with that base firmly in place, then you can improvise. You can't play jazz riffs until you know all the notes. Someone who exemplifies what Julia was talking about is Chef Anita Lowe. Before opening her Michelin-starred and beloved Greenwich Village restaurant Anissa, Anita did some serious training. After studying French in college, she worked in acclaimed restaurant kitchens in France and then New York, as well as attended the Ritz Escoffier Cooking School in Paris. When she opened Anissa, it was a rare chef-owned and run independent restaurant. Its delicious dishes married fine dining with global cuisine. Her approach to improvising, based on the skills she learned in France and French restaurants in New York, combined with her world travels and Chinese heritage, led Anissa to earn both a 3-star review from the New York Times and a Michelin star many years running. Ask anyone who's eaten there, and they will wax nostalgic about Anita's foie gras soup dumplings. Welcome to the podcast, Anita.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. We're excited. So your new book focuses on cooking for one, but it's also dedicated to your life partner. So since you aren't a singleton, what's the story that you were setting out to tell with Solo?
I think it should be okay to be alone. I think people need to be alone. And I did want to tell people that, you're not alone if someone breaks up with you.
So it's a book for all of those moments?
It's for all of those moments, but it's for, it can be, the recipes are easily multiplied, so, and it's a lot easier to multiply than to divide, so it's, you know, I just, it, this book was for the people that were cooking for themselves, but if you happen to have a partner or you want to cook for four people or whatever, you can multiply by however many times you need to multiply.
So there's like an exponential factor. And do you think most of the recipes in the book are easily done times two, times four, or there are some that are more scalable than others?
Well, probably. I mean, I haven't really thought about that, but yeah, most of them multiplied by two is very, very easy. Multiplied by four should be easy too. I can't imagine. I mean, sure, there's probably some that are easier than others for multiplying, but they're all doable either way.
And so one of the things I was really struck by in reading through it is that it's full of very personal, charming, but personal anecdotes, in addition to the what I think are really inviting and a diverse set of recipe. So was that in the original plan when you went to write the book, to put your kind of heart and soul on every page, or is that just sort of what happened in the process?
You know, I think it's kind of a stretch to say that I put my heart and soul on it, but it, yeah, I mean, I think in order to tell people that they are not alone when someone's broken up with you, you have to tell some of those stories. Yeah, I mean, I think my proposal certainly had one of those stories in it. So, but yeah, you're supposed to write what you know, and you know, what do I know? I have my experiences. So.
And do you feel like when you developed the book that it was kind of like dedicated to everyone who's been in those moments of being broken up with, or single, or being single and wanting to be with someone else? Is it sort of dedicated to them as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I just don't understand how some people have never cooked for themselves. I just, you know, it's like, didn't you go to college? Didn't you graduate from college at one point? I mean, I just, yeah. But I guess, you know, it's a lot of people just order in or get takeout, and it's a lot, it's cheaper, and it's a lot more healthy to cook for yourself, to cook at home.
When the book launched, which was about a month ago or so, right, did you find that you just people kept saying, oh, I never cook for myself. I never would do that. I just order in. Is that something like a kind of repeating pattern that you found either before or after?
Well, yeah, I've heard that. However, the book is selling like hotcakes, so clearly there's a need for this. It's just, yeah, I think there is some sort of cultural norm about, you know, that people wouldn't want to just cook for just themselves. Mm. When that's strange, I think, yeah.
And don't you think, I hear it a lot from people, particularly chefs that I know, that after cooking for tons of other people, they just don't have the energy or motivation or willpower to actually cook for themselves. I mean, it sounds like you always have, but was that also something you were thinking about in creating this?
Oh, that's not true. When I was cooking on the line and running a restaurant, you know, coming home and cooking was kind of out of the question. But but before that, I certainly was cooking for myself, and I guess on the line, I did a lot of like single, we would do those tasting menus, and when you were a regular and you came there all the time and you've had everything on the menu, I would do things off menu for them. And so basically you're cooking, you know, for one or two at that point. You're basically cooking for one because it's usually split up. If it's two people eating. So yeah, I've certainly had a lot of chefs say, I have no idea how to cook for less than 40, but.
And that's true. I guess I was thinking there's also a difference of, you know, some of the people I've been talking to lately are private chefs, so they're not doing staff meal and things like a restaurant might all the time, where the chef might have eaten then or early. But if you're, you know, catering or private chefing for a large group, by the end of that, you're just spent and you probably haven't eaten other than what you've been tasting as you go along.
Yeah. I mean, even when I was cooking, though, I would make soups and salads and stuff like that for myself. Hmm.
Well, I was really, this book really made me think about my own experiences cooking, because I realized that I'm just not a takeout person in general, and definitely don't do it for just myself. I would sooner cook, but obviously I'm doing that in situations where I'm pressed for time or it's really late. But I feel like one of the things that I related to is that when you cook for one, at least in my experience, it's often you're not going out shopping. So you're opening the fridge, seeing what there is, opening the pantry. And I do feel like I've kind of invented my own, some of my favorite dishes, that it kind of forces you into that sense of discovery and invention for lack of options. Is that also something that was part of where a lot of these recipes came from for you too?
Yeah, some of them. I mean, I did try to put myself in that situation and say, well, what do I have? You know, can I make a dish from something that would just be found in your pantry? And that would be, you know, balanced. And I think that's where I think there's a pasta dish with like charred lemons and something in there. But yeah.
And so I'm also a big fan of the toaster oven, and will evangelize about using one. I think especially when you're just by yourself, and in the example I just gave of like not being someone who likes takeout too much, that the toaster oven is an amazing thing. And so I really love that you included that as a key tool in cooking solo. So do you have some favorite toaster oven dishes that you love?
Yeah, I mean, so many things can be done in a toaster oven. I had when I was living in Paris, that was the only oven I had. And it was a pretty, it was a big one, so you could roast a small chicken in there. But I did anything that you can fit in there, basically, that you do in a regular oven, you can do in a toaster oven. But what's great about a toaster oven is that you can set it to turn off by itself. So, you know, if you're toasting nuts, or so many chefs have burnt the crap out of nuts by shoving them in the oven, in the toaster oven it just turns off automatically, and you can you don't have to worry about it.
No, I agree. That is a great tip. Toasting nuts for recipes, especially when you just need them, just a point to be toasted, the toaster oven is an amazing tool because, yeah, it's so easy to burn them. Do you have any, so now that you're not living on the edge in Paris with only a toaster oven, what do you still like to make or for yourself on the go with the toaster oven?
Oh, I still use my toaster oven all the time. I mean, in the city, my actual oven is more of a storage space, so it's like a big
like
ordeal.
A true New Yorker.
Yeah, like it's a big ordeal to actually cook something in there. So I broiled some fish in there last night for myself and my partner.
So for you, is it like an everyday tool that you just use all the time still?
Yeah, absolutely. And I bought it in a grocery store in Long Island for $25.
And you have a more expensive oven that you use for storage.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, it's not a fancy oven by any means. The one in the city, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I would wager. What percentage do you think of New York City ovens are used for storage rather than cooking? Probably 70 to 80.
At least, probably more.
Yes. Yes, my relatives in New York definitely never use their oven for anything but storage.
So. Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about what is kind of a running sub-theme of the book, is that you have lots of helpful tips about eliminating waste. And, I get that chefs are very frugal and use stuff, maybe in more comprehensive ways than people do at home. But why was that important to you to include in Solo?
Well, I think it's hard to it's a little bit harder to shop for one and to cook for one and not have waste, because everything at the grocery store is put in cellophane for a family of four. So, I always found that annoying. I mean, I also come from a crazy no-waste family. And even when I was in France, that concept of not wasting food was pounded into me. I mean, I had a sous chef at Boulay that used to check our garbage.
And where do you think the tradition in French cooking comes from? Is it environmental? Is it just saving money? Or is it kind of all of those things mashed up together?
Well, I'm sure it's all of those things mashed up together. But I think, French cuisine was born out of poverty. And so I think it's an economic issue. But yes, it's an ecologic issue as well. And
Well, that's interesting. I've never had that conversation on a podcast. What does that mean that French cooking was born out of poverty?
Well, all of these sauces were developed, all these French, sauces were developed to mask the off flavors of the meat. So they have come up with these really great sauces to make things more palatable.
To compensate.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that kind of is a mind-blowing thing, which now that you say that, I have heard that before, but because I think Americans have this view of French food as fancy, right? They're almost synonymous, and that the fanciness came from a totally different side of things. In fact, maybe wasn't considered fancy.
Right. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't really know. I'm not a historian. But yeah, I think, back in the day they didn't have refrigeration and, things would go off.
Mm. And so back to your book, it sounds like your view, it wasn't so much that you were trying to take some great environmental stand. You just were looking at that there's a certain inefficiency in cooking for one and trying to provide help in that regard. Was that the goal of the tips?
Well, I mean, I personally don't like waste for those reasons as well. But I do think first and foremost it was... It is a problem of cooking for one that needs to be solved.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back to talk to Anita about life after Aniso. We'll be right back. From rushing around shopping to all those social gatherings, it's all too easy to fall into bad eating habits around the holidays. But Bob's Red Mill to the rescue with its new muesli cups, perfect for winter on the go. Choose from three delicious varieties: gluten-free with raisins, cranberries, apples, and almonds; gluten-free tropical with mangoes, strawberries, macadamia nuts, and coconut; and even a paleo version that's grain-free. Just add milk or yogurt, hot or cold, and you have a hearty breakfast or snack packed with fiber and protein to keep you going. Visit bobsredmill.com today, use the discount code JuliasKitchenPod, all one word in all caps, for valuable savings, a new muesli cups. Welcome back. We're talking to Chef Anita Lowe, former chef owner of New York's Anissa Restaurant. We've been talking to her about her new cookbook Solo, and now we're turning the conversation to what comes next. So Danny Meyer was on our podcast last week, and he spoke about how sometimes ending things, closing a restaurant, although bittersweet, can be done in a celebratory rather than kind of defeatist way. Did you feel that way about closing Anissa, that there was any celebration to the end of an era, or did it feel like you were forced into it?
Oh, no, it was a decision that I made, and it was the right decision. And yeah, we had a bunch of parties at the end that made it really, yeah, certainly celebratory.
So do you agree with that approach, that more restaurants should sort of shut that way, or is it very situationally dependent?
I think it's situationally dependent. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that some restaurants get shut down by their landlords or whatever happens, and Anissa, we had a good run. And I was going to shut it down at the end of my lease, which was like two more years anyway, but because of a whole bunch of reasons, it just seemed to be the right time at that time, so, and I don't regret it.
Well, that's great to hear, and I can still visualize being in your lovely dining room, and the restaurant had such a wonderful, intimate setting, which I think is maybe, do you think, sadly, a thing of the past of intimate restaurants, or, you know, in terms of small number of tables, like harder and harder to run?
Oh, certainly in New York City. That being said, you'll find them. It's just they'll be rarer.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think that because running a restaurant in New York has become more and more expensive, and I'm sure that's the same in a place like San Francisco or Hong Kong, do you think that's going to drive independent chef-owned restaurants kind of out of major cities, and you'll have to comb the suburbs to and even smaller cities to find them? Do you think that's the trend that we're looking at?
Well, certainly. I mean, that has been the trend for a while now. A lot of chefs leaving New York City. And if you look at who's really successful here, you know, they're big corporations for the most part. Or people are trying to do fast casual, et cetera. That being said, yeah, there's still some people that are holding on and having their small restaurants here. So
do you think the living wage increase that's going in New York, or maybe it's gone in, is going to make that more and more challenging for any of those kind of restaurants to open?
Oh, certainly. That being said, I'm all for it. I just wish that they had, you know, we should have been raising the minimum wage incrementally over a longer period of time. I mean, the minimum wage didn't raise for I don't know how long. Or it went really incrementally, and then suddenly it just was jumping. And that's very difficult on a business. And what you're finding is that clients aren't willing to pay for that.
Mm. Well, especially when it's a sudden increase.
Exactly.
Versus a
Exactly, yeah.
So do you think, or have you heard, are cities, I mean, I'm thinking of the cities where the concentration of rent is so expensive, like New York and San Francisco. I think LA and Chicago are not quite as bad. I don't really know, but just guessing from the dynamics, do you think like New York, or have you heard, are they putting things in place to, because obviously one of the things that makes New York so desirable is it's unique. And if it just has a bunch of chain restaurants or restaurants that are very generic, it's not going to have the same attraction. So do you think the city should be doing more to kind of help, you know, independent run restaurants survive, or are they doing it?
Oh, they absolutely should be doing more. I don't know where they are. I just, you know, they did, at one point they started this sort of, this group that was headed by one guy who was hired by the mayor to try to address these issues. And then it just disappeared. Like, they really didn't get anything done. And then, so I don't know where the mayor is on this. I think, there were things that we know that he was aware of that he said that he, you know, I think he seems to be ignoring it. So I don't know.
And do you think it's just not, it's not a much of a, it's not in a sort of crisis mode where there's much focus on it because it's not yet really so impacted the visitors and the people who live there?
Well, it's certainly, yeah. I mean, it's New York City. There's plenty of other crises that are much more important than the restaurant, the high-end restaurant industry. So that may be what's going on, yeah.
And do you think that that's where it's really focused on the high end rather than the pizza places and the takeaway shops?
Oh, well, I think that's got to be hard for them too. I mean, the smaller places, you know, like that increase in for the servers, that makes sense for because we had an increase in what businesses had to pay their servers, and it just basically got doubled. Which is understandable when you're a small sort of diner like place. It makes sense, but for like a high end restaurant where waiters are making a lot of money in tips, it didn't really make sense.
Hmm. And so do you think? I know we also talked last week to Danny Meyer a lot about his no tipping policy, because I think on a sort of social level, it's really fascinating, and the obviously, and I know you've said you support the living wage, but it's changing a very long-standing dynamic that a lot of businesses were built around. So do you think the no tipping policy and the coordinating wage is the wave of the future, or is it still too soon to tell?
It's too soon to tell, but I, you know, having the last year of Anissa, we had a no tipping policy, and I think we do need to have more equity between the front of the house and the back of the house and how they're paid. Yeah, I mean, the people, I don't know why clients, they just forget about, I guess because you're not seeing the cooks, but the cooks, they're making nothing. And I don't know, it's just so hard to live in New York City and make, you know, what cooks are making. And yeah.
Do you think that's actually the crisis that's coming? Because you're at least the second or third person of late who's talked to me and our audience about that there is a looming affordability crisis in New York about getting people from front of house and back of house to be able to work and afford to live there. Do you think that is something that is going to come to the head, or it's part of the ongoing forever struggle of big cities?
It's not looming. It's here. Yeah, I mean, there's a we don't have enough cooks in general in the city. I think it's a nationwide problem. But yeah, I don't know how you live in any of the boroughs these days and on a cook's wage. I think when stuff like this happens, you need to make transportation stronger. So if we could get better infrastructure there, we could get people in from places that where the cost of living is less. But you know, that infrastructure seems to be failing as well. So yeah, we're in a bind right now.
And so do you see that? Are there just help wanted signs all over New York City and in restaurants and places that need line cooks, and are places closing because they don't have the staff?
I don't know about places closing, but it's just, you know, that was one of the big reasons why I closed Anissa. It was just too much of a headache, you know, constantly dealing with the lack of cooks. And, you know, everywhere, you know, people... All of my friends who still have restaurants or are working in restaurants are like, yeah, we're down a cook this week. Yeah, this one left, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just, or they've got, you know, the quality of the line cooks have gone down as well, I think. You know, I don't know. It's because, you know, everyone we're taking, there's only so many of us, I guess.
I guess a conservative economist would say, well, the laws of supply and demand mean that if the supply is dropping, then to stimulate the demand, everyone's going to have to start paying, you know, the living wage plus 10 plus 20%. Is that already happening, or is there a reason that sort of can't happen?
No, that's already happening, but the reason why it can't happen is because, you know, clients aren't really willing to pay for a meal what it takes to give, you know, to give everybody in a restaurant a living wage.
So it seems like something that is going to come to a head for cities, especially expensive cities, to deal with, at least at some point soon.
Right. I mean, I think, I don't know, in Australia they've been able to deal with this from what I've heard. But, you know, I think people spend a lot of money on dinner there.
So that the inevitable is that eating out and even takeaway places are going to get more expensive.
Well, true. Or people are going to choose to eat more, to eat in less expensive places, which is already happening, which is, you know, this proliferation of fast casual.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about something a little peppier. Yeah. We're going to a dark future of no fine dining.
Well, that's not going to happen. But yeah, there will always be fine dining. It's just, yeah.
So I know you like to travel, and I was curious about what you do with Tour de Forks, and if you could tell us about you. I know you did an interesting trip recently, and you have an upcoming trip. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, we did two trips with the Tour de Forks to Mexico, to Mérida in the Yucatan Peninsula, and we stay in this fantastic hacienda, Hacienda Pitac, which you can't just go to. You have to rent out the whole place in order to stay there, and it's, you know, it's very luxurious, and we don't ever take more than 12 people. So it's a nice, so it's easier, and yeah, we go to the market. We have cooking classes. We have we go see some Mayan ruins. And then in the next year, we go to a cenote, etc. It's a wonderful trip. And next year we're going to be going to Portugal. And doing pretty much, I mean, we won't be going to cenotes, but we'll be focusing on food and, you know, food tourism. And I'll be teaching a class there as well.
And so just sticking on the Yucatan and Merida, are you doing that trip also next year in the fall?
That remains to be seen. But, yeah, perhaps we'll do that every year. It's a really nice place to go. So,
and do you do the cooking class at the Hacienda?
Yes, they have a lovely sort of demo kitchen there. Actually, it's not even a demo kitchen. It's a hands-on cooking class, so it could be a demo kitchen. It could be either. So, but we do hands-on.
And what's the focus of the trip to Portugal?
Food, of course.
We're gonna are you going like all over the entire country? Or are you going to one place and region or?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think I know that we're going to be spending some time in the capital, and I know that we're going out. We're going to the countryside and staying in this beautiful, beautiful hotel. We're going to be making some cheese there. We're going to go to a Michelin-starred restaurant. I'm not exactly sure the final itinerary.
Yeah, no, I was reading. It's almost a year from now, right?
Yes.
Is it next fall?
Yes.
And so I was curious, because obviously I know that you have traveled and like to travel. What's the attraction of joining up and sort of making it a job? Or are you the leader, or are you kind of a participant along with the other people and just the sort of chef expert?
I'm just the chef expert. And then, yeah, I'm the leader only on the day that I'm, or the time that I'm cooking. That I'm teaching the cooking class.
So otherwise you're kind of one of the group.
Yes.
Okay. And do you get something out of these that you haven't been getting in your personal travels, or what is it that you enjoy about them?
Well, it you know, the Tour de Forks is owned by two people that are good friends of mine. And they usually come along, and so we have a really good time. And I get to meet new people. And, So, I mean, you know, by doing this class, I don't have to pay for the trip. And, it's nice.
And the Tour de Forks, does it have a particular mission, or is it sort of travel for people who want to spend all their time thinking about and eating food, or...?
Yeah, it's culinary travel, but there's, you know, it's curated. It is sort of higher end, although they can, you know, they will do personal trips for however you want to travel. You should check it out. It's www.tourdeforks.com.
Great. So you, in other words, if you had a group of 10 or something like that, or I don't know what number, you could go to them and say you could do they would do a private itinerary plan for you as well.
They would do that for one or two or however many you want as well.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, from our tours, the tours that we make and try to sell are no more than 12, yeah.
Oh, okay. So you've also said that you don't see yourself opening another restaurant. So is there anything crystallizing yet in terms of what will be next, or are you living in the moment?
Well, you know, I don't see myself opening another restaurant of my own, in that I don't particularly at this age want to own another restaurant. But I would clearly open another restaurant for somebody else and be sort of a long-term consultant. And that's what I'm actively seeking right now.
So sorry, that means that, in other words, you wouldn't be the owner, but you might be the executive chef?
Right. Yeah. Sort of consultant chef. I mean, I can't, I had a knee replacement that wasn't that successful. So it's really hard for me to be on my feet all the time. So I'm hoping to get something where I could set it up, and you know, make sure it's running properly, and then walk away and check in and make sure it's do quality checks every once in a while.
I see. And so are you in conversations about doing that?
Yes.
But no big news yet?
No, not at all. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. After the break, Anita's going to share her Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mess like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. Anita, what's your Julia moment?
So, I once had the good fortune of cooking for Julia Child when I was the executive chef of Maxime's, which was up on 60th Street. And she came in for lunch, and I was in my 20s at that time. I don't remember how old I was, but I was probably somewhere near 25 or something like that, 26. And I had prepared this elaborate, you know, tasting menu for her. I was getting everything ready. I was really excited. And she came in, and I went out to the table. I was like, yes, I'd be happy to cook for you, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh, I think I'll have the roast chicken. And so, yeah, so that's what I made for her. It was basically like a pan-roasted half chicken with mashed potatoes and some sort of sauce and some sort of some sort of vegetable. But
well, the chefs often say their last meal would be roast chicken. So
there you go.
So did the whole tasting menu, had you prepped this entire tasting menu?
Yes, of course, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, it did teach me that, you know, you need to nail the simple things as well.
Mm. And did you get feedback on the pan-roasted chicken?
I think she really enjoyed it.
But that moment is stuck with you from the contrast between the elaborate to the simple?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's lovely. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. And thanks everyone for listening. Do you cook for yourself? What are your favorite solo dishes? Send us an email or even a voice memo to contact at juliachildfoundation.org. You can follow the foundation, as always, on social media. Our handles are at Julia Child on Facebook, at Julia Child Foundation, all one word, on Instagram, and at Julia Child JCF on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at T Shulkin, TSCHULKIN. You can also follow Anita. Her handle is at Anita Lowe, LONYC, on Twitter and Instagram. And if you're interested, as she mentioned in her travel journeys, check out tourdeforks.com. And as I said, while next year's trip to Portugal is currently sold out, it clearly pays to get on their mailing list early for future trips. Anita's beautiful new cookbook is Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one, published by Knopf. Find it at your favorite online or bricks and mortar bookseller now. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, who today is Jeet rather than the usual Matt. And our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. Please give us a review, which will help new listeners discover the show. And don't forget to subscribe. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after on Stitcher, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.